Accession number 8941, rule number 9.
Major Jefferson, reel 9. Yes, I think the last thing you said was that the Hunnies were going across the gun line.
Yes. Well, here's John Mays answering a question of mine, question 18 of a questionnaire I sent him. I remember some armour, Hunnies or cars, stopping at the gun and asking Bob Bentham and me for information. The chap in the vehicle became horribly frustrated because neither Bob or I could hear a thing. He probably thought we were being stupid. The vehicle finally moved across from our left to right. It wasn't anything heavier than Hunnies, and I feel it was one of those yeomanry type regiments. That's John Mays, memory of the Hunnies. And I think I've already said that Nobby Clark remembered them going across his sights when he was acting as a layer in E Troop.
Have you any idea how many of them there were to take part in this attack?
Quite a small number. If there were more than 20 or less than 12, I'd be surprised.
And how far away from you were they when they were sitting to your...
This chap actually stopped at one of our guns and asked the way.
Mm. But before they'd actually moved into the attack,
they were
your left rear, I think you said.
Yes. Well, I can tell you the exact position off that map, if I can remember where I put that map. Well, Rob Cole were there, underneath the ridge. That was our forward line, and there is where the Hunnies went across us. Yeah, it's where they reached the ridge. And there is the Armoured Brigade. I think it's the 22nd Armoured Brigade. Though it was, in fact, a mishmash of the few remaining armoured vehicles that were left. And that distance is 7,000 or 8,000 yards. And apart from the Hunnies, that's as near as they ever got to the battle.
What did they have besides the Hunnies then? The Hunnies were light, weren't they?
Yes. Well, there were about a dozen Grants. That was all that were left at that time. And they had, in fact, orders not to get involved. So, although we didn't like them very much for it, I think that it was probably not as ununderstandable as it appeared to us at the time.
Is it possible they have been held back for a last-ditch counterattack?
It is possible. And indeed, the Grants, I'm quite certain, were that day told not to get involved. That doesn't mean that the day before they oughtn't to have been in the Dare or Shine. And it doesn't mean that we liked them for it. And it was indeed Bob Loder Simmons of 1st RHA who was largely responsible in making certain that they stayed there. I don't think they were all that happy that day. And they had every reason not to be, because there were just about 12 Grants left after the British Army. And these few Hunnies were all that was left out of umpteen regiments. They were the Blues and Loyals at the time, was what they were known as, but there was probably only one of each, and the remainder of other regiments, just as we had a troop of guns which only had one of our guns in.
What happened to that attack by the Hunnies? Was it successful?
I think it certainly is likely to have helped our position. Whether it was successful or unsuccessful, I don't know, because I don't know what their orders were. But they certainly made a lot of noise on our right, and I should think that they helped to decide the Germans not to come further forward. Though by now the battle on our position, they were a bit late in the battle to... But that doesn't mean they weren't any less helpful, of course. Difficult to say.
Did you actually ever see any tanks forward of your, or to the right of your command post in that
enemy tank
battle? Yes.
If you're looking at the Rowisett Ridge, a tank behind the Rowisett Ridge is only a little dot anyway. Yeah. I saw what I know were tanks, but that's not like saying you saw a tank in 1985. I saw little humps and they flashed and went bang. But they were more like tar barrels than...
Were they keeping hull down then, behind the crest?
Yes, I think that they later made a charge against Dietrich. I didn't see that. By the time I saw them, they were certainly held down behind the crest. And I think most of the time they were, because several of my correspondents talk of using HE cap on and wishing they got armour piercing and realising that if they'd been able to choose the way to fight the battle, it wouldn't be the way they were doing it.
But one presumes that the Germans had run out of steam by the time darkness.
By the time darkness fell, they pulled off the battlefield just as we did, and at the same time as we did. But they got fairly close to the guns just before that. And to that extent, I think perhaps the Hunnies' action may well have been a bigger factor than I, perhaps in my own mind, given them credit for.
From what you said, it does seem that they got within effective machine gun range.
Oh, certainly.
Have been fairly close.
Oh, yes, they were certainly. But they were with effective machine gun range, they were much closer than that. Because, I say, we opened up in the afternoon battle at 2,900. Well, that's already effective for a heavy machine gun. But they got within a few hundred yards at the end of the day.
Was it a fairly common thing to break off battle as soon as darkness fell and to retire?
It was a normal thing.
Normal thing.
And equally, the next morning was a rush to get your OP and have your crap before the German OP did the same.
Why was that? Was this a matter of necessity or convenience, or was it a matter of mutual battlefield courtesy as a convention?
I don't think that courtesy came in, because I say one of our biggest hopes was to get there early enough to catch him while he was having his constitutional. That's not very courteous.
It has a sort of grim gamesmanship to it.
Yes, but the next day, on the 3rd of July, we actually stayed on the battlefield. Yeah, we said, and again, this was Jeff Armstrong who said it. He said, "We have the best seats, and we'll keep them." But the situation was totally fluid. The normal thing, anyway, would be to withdraw into lager at night. Where you had that lager would be where you felt happiest, obviously. It certainly seemed that night the wise thing to do, to withdraw X thousand yards, where X is a fairly small number, and collect up what we'd got to collect up. I don't think by then we knew how much we'd got to collect up. We knew we'd only left one dead gun on the field itself. But we'd had heavy casualties, both of men and material, and the actual field of battle isn't necessarily the best place to... I suppose if we'd been at Waterloo, we would at least have closed back on Quatre Bras.
Do you know what it was that actually knocked the guns out? You've mentioned that earlier on that casualties occurred because machine gun fire came under the shields and HE shells sent fragments under the shields and round the shields. But what was it that actually knocked guns out? And
the one gun that was knocked out, which was a number 3 gun in Dontran, was, I am pretty certain, AP shot, because it cut both Sergeant Eggleston and his layer in half, or it and a subsequent one. It castrated poor old Eggleston, and he was the chap who was crying to be shot. The number 1 gun of Don Troop, I don't know, but again, since it happened at the same time, I suspect it was AP shot, because it was a direct hit again. The casualties in E Troop, the one gun that was useless in E Troop when we brought it back was a gun that I think came from the 32nd Field. It was certainly Slim Slight, who was a subaltern in the 11th Field, who, during a period when they were down to their last two shells, sat in the layer seat and stuffed one shell down the front end and one shell down the back end and pulled the trigger. And that came back as a banana split. The remaining casualties in E Troop would, I suspect, be much more due to HE splinters and machine gun bullets than to a solid shot. And indeed, the major problems in E Troop were mechanical. I mean, number one gun, or at least I think it was number one, which was Keelan's gun. He had 3 killed, certainly, and 4 killed, possibly, on the gun. But in the end, his main problem was that his breech block stuck. Yeah, that was why that gun became useless.
Would that be a result of overheating?
I don't think that the breech block would stick for it. I just don't know why breech blocks stick. But his did, and I've got a vivid description of them trying to knock it out with a heavy iron mallet thing from Wilkie. Wilkie's gun was still firing. The number 3 gun had been blown up. The other 2 must have been recuperators or something of that sort. Just 48 hours later, they were okay again.
Did you have a lot of trouble keeping recuperators going?
I didn't, because I was command post officer. But the chaps like John Mays is very good on things. Whereas I'm more on ideas and people. But John Mays was very explicit in 1 or 2 of his letters about the recuperators, about the, I think it would be called the liners wearing out in today's language, the actual rifling of the gun. The recuperator problems were, well, certainly Tiffy Davis and Tiffy Heenan were both very busy under shell fire and under machine gun fire working on the front end of the gun, and that was where the recuperator is got at. But I'm not mechanical, it doesn't mean a great deal to me.
Do you know what sort of tanks were attacking you?
They were mostly Mark 3s. And less. But Mark 3 would be the most common one. They're only 26, so you can undoubtedly verify it somewhere. Although they're 26 next morning, 37 the night before. They probably were some Mark 4s by then, but I don't think they're anything higher than Mark 4 at that time in the war.
What did you do in your overnight period then, when the battle was stopped? Was it all a matter of moving and getting into a new position? Was there any opportunity to feed and to sleep and to get yourself sorted out?
Certainly, a number of us, I can see us under a very large tarpaulin. I don't know where it came from. I don't remember whether we fed or not, but we'd all our trucks would have food on. I mean,
that's a matter of standard procedure, isn't it?
It would have been possible to get something at any time. I mean, it wouldn't have been the Ritz, but if you know, provided we had some water, we could chuck it into a petrol tin and brew something up.
What happened the next day then? When
the next morning, July the 3rd, the 7884 battery went out into battle, and they took with them Sergeant Wilkinson, who was the one of the two chaps who had come from 164, successors of 157. I'd say it every time because people otherwise will think that I'm not right, because a lot of people don't realise there ever was a 164. George Wilkinson was the only fully serviceable gun next morning. He had been wounded twice on the 2nd, and he went out with them on the 3rd and got wounded the 3rd time, and this time evacuated. We had, by now, we got bits of our battery round this tarpaulin that I can remember. Of the 11 officers actually on the battle, on the order of battle our battery, seven had been wounded in some way or another, but most of them were still, no, about five of them were still on the around. And during the course of the day, our donkey was brought back from being mended. At least three guns were made battle-worthy. At some stage during that day, I was called across to a hole in the ground that was then RHQ, because I don't know why RHQ was by now stabilised. Perhaps it was the 4th that this happened, but I think it was the 3rd. Anyway, Dougie came out of this hole in the ground and said to me, what's that over there, Jeff? And I broke my glasses in the true, so I was fairly blind, actually, on the 2nd of July. But instinctively, of course, I put my glasses up to my eyes and said, oh, that's a couple of tar barrels. And he said, OK, you're commander of non-troop. He'd been seeing that I could see that far, and fortunately I got my glasses around my neck, as I have this very minute. And so I took over non-troop, and I think it was the next day we went off with and formed one troop with the 11th HAC, to form a composite battery. But we spent the day sort of making and mending.
What do you mean by making and mending?
Well, I said people working on recuperators, me going across to RHQ and being given command of a troop to replace a casualty. Undoubtedly, three tunners went off down the Alex Road to get some ammunition, and others went off for food, but rations, I was not very much aware of that when an army in the desert, it's a bit like a moving jigsaw. Every bit's in place, and you know the bits that are on the other side of you, and you're aware of being part of a whole, but you don't ask too many questions about the piece three bits along or
What did Don Troop consist of when you took command?
When I took command, there were three guns. And I have a picture in this very book of what I took over at that time. There is me. This is the day when we were a troop of... so this is the 4th, I think, of July.
So the day after you took command.
The day after I took command. It's the day that a lot of Italians tried to surrender and got machine gunned down by the Germans. and it's the day that we were a troop, and alongside us was the remains of 11th HAC, and the OPs that day were HAC OPs. And they had real HAC voices, and despite the beauty of their wireless discipline, Charles. And
instantly identifiable by friend or enemy.
Yes, yes. And that is actually me. And you'll see there's an artillery one. I've probably got the actual original. No, no. I certainly have got the original here somewhere. Yes, there. There's me at the RT board next day. I still only got... Well, I have more than one pip anyway, so I can't see that. That's Tiffy Heenan. Acting as GPOAC. There is one of my guns, and that's Sergeant Jeffs, who was number one gun D troop that day. That's Sergeant Lane, who was probably number two gun D troop on the 2nd of July. And there is, well, that's us again. And somewhere here we've got an excellent picture of the command post. That is the command post. I mean, there is Sergeant Chambers, the signal NCO, and there is Turberfield, Sergeant Turberfield, who was Battery Sergeant Major at the beginning of the action in Don Troop. And John describes how when the R. Edward rushed in and Captain Boyd shouted, "Tanks approaching, gun control." Turberfield, whose place was in the command post, said to Wilson, whose place was also in the command post, "With nothing much left for us to do here," and they went out together onto guns. And Turberfield did everybody who was there speaks very highly of the way he conducted himself that day. To answer your question, by the evening I had the nucleus of a troop of three guns.
How many bodies did you have to actually serve the guns?
I believe that the battery ration strength that day, I think I'm right in saying it was 87. The battery, yeah. We'd had 100 casualties of one sort or another on the 2nd of July, of which 20-odd were missing, some of whom came back, because they were indeed missing.
They just got lost, had they, during the...
Well, they were...
All wounded. Well,
as we pulled back. No, wounded were... we got the numbers of that. According to one of the historical documents, and I'm not 100% certain it's exactly right, because I've been finding errors, but this states the casualties in 83-85 battery were 12 BORs killed, 7 officers wounded, 55 BORs wounded, and 26 BORs missing. Of the 26 BORs who are missing, a certain number, I don't know how many, turned up again, because they've merely gone down the other road or...
But in your troop, in your Don troop, what sort of numbers did you have available to...
Well, if the battery was 47... Well, I was the battery. I mean, 87 was the battery ration strength next morning, best of my knowledge and belief.
What about the other troop, the E troop, that had been in the battery? Did that...
Well, I became the battery, in effect, because...
So the two were amalgamated,
yes,
were they?
Yes, yeah. It says here, and I'm quoting again from a document I'm not 100% happy with, but it's not far out. Out of the 9 guns with which 83-85 battery started the day, 2 were complete wrecks. That's Eggleston, which was a direct hit. Sheringham, Franklin, that was blown up by Slight. 6 were repairable, and only 1 was actually serviceable that morning. Now, of the 6 that were repairable, 3 were repaired fairly quickly and made my Don troop, and a couple of days later they were all okay and we had a battery again, but the next day I was just a troop of 11th HAC, in effect. Or they were 83-85 battery. Yeah.
Did you have enough trained men to actually lay and fire the guns competently?
The next day?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I mean, if you look at that squad of thugs here, those are all chaps who were with me in India.
What was... And
in any case, every one of us could lay and fire at that time.
What was their physical and mental condition like when you took over command?
When I took command?
Yes.
Well, you can look at that picture. That's the 3rd of July. Either they're very fond of having their photographs taken, or they are fairly cheerful. Can you see Sergeant Jeffs there? Now, the night before, I can prove to you that he was in quite a bad way, because he was tired out and he'd had his gun knocked out under him. But he doesn't look all that bad that day, does he? That's Nobby Hall. That's Bombardier Parrott, I think, who was killed 2 days later, so it must have been. That's Sergeant Lane. But when you don't get the impression that, I mean, there's three professionals at work. That's old Bob Bentham, who was smoking his pipe just as he smoked it on the 2nd of July. There are the chaps on the guns. Here are the two technical chaps, the signal sergeant and the troop sergeant major by now. I think that their pictures speak for themselves, that these chaps are fairly well under control of themselves.
Certainly they don't appear to show any signs of exhaustion, so presumably a night's rest was enough to put them back on their
well,
feet.
Well, Sergeant Jeffs, who is one of the toughest nuts I know, you will hear from Chalky that night he'd about had it. But he doesn't look all that bad there, does he?
How did you find 11th HAC compared to your own regiment?
I don't know that I was ever conscious of them myself at that time. It wasn't until later when I met Jeff Armstrong many years later that I actually got down to the way we worked together.
What did you do then on the 4th?
Well, as I say, assuming that this was the 4th, and I'm pretty certain it was, having taken over command of the troop, we went out with 11th HAC and we fired at under command of 11th HAC. Oh, yes, in a sense you've just confused me, because of course I was aware of their voices. They were on the blower, and I've already said that they were very much yeomanry voices, but I don't think I actually met any of them that day. And we fired fairly heavily that day, and some Italians, I think they must have been, tried to give themselves up, and the Germans behind them didn't think that was a very good idea. And this is well documented in